Have you noticed that time travel is having a moment? I'm Anne Strangechamps, stuck here in the present. But on network TV this season, the stars of four new series are wandering all over time.
You're H.G. Wells.
Yes.
You wrote the time machine.
No, not yet. I haven't.
My father wasn't murdered. I remember it both ways. Life when he was murdered, life when he wasn't. Everything has changed.
Something screwed up the American Revolution, and you're the only person that knows enough about history to help me out. Prepare to have your mind blown.
A really big duffel bag?
It's a time machine.
I'm not sure you realize where you are, boy.
I hope you live long enough to see Michael Jordan dunk, Michael Jackson dance, Mike Tyson punch, really just any black guy named Michael, because the future is not on your side.
Time travel and time machines are big themes on TV this season. And what exactly does that say about the present? That we'd like a chance to hit rewind, fix some mistakes, take a different path? Of course, time travel has been a popular theme in movies and TV shows for a very long time. Remember Back to the Future, Doctor Who, or one of Steve Paulson's all-time favorites?
Two American scientists are lost in the swirling maze of past and future ages during the first experiments on America's greatest and most secret project, the Time Tunnel.
The Time Tunnel. That was such a great show. You know, I loved that show. These two guys would walk into this swirling tunnel and they get thrown back into time. And I used to watch it with my brother, and we were both history geeks. Going back to when Lincoln was assassinated, there was the French Revolution. There was one episode even going back to the Trojan War.
The Time Tunnel.
Well, James Glick also has the time travel bug. He's a science writer with a particular interest in the cultural impact of technology. And he's written a number of best-selling books, including The Information, Faster, and Chaos. And Glick's just come out with a mind-bending book called Time Travel, A History. So, of course, I wondered what got him hooked on this idea of going back and forward into time.
I think the thing that really triggered the book for me was a surprising discovery, a surprising realization. At least it was a surprise to me. And that was that when H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine in 1895, that was the first time anyone had considered the idea of time travel. I always imagined, and I think most people imagine, that time travel is an ancient idea, that it's always been with us, that for all of human history we had these fantasies that we all have today of being able to hop into a machine or walk through a door and find ourselves magically transported either into the future where things are going to be wonderful and strange, or back to the past where we get to meet Napoleon or the pharaohs or Queen Elizabeth. But it turns out that that's not true, that when H.G. Wells came up with this wacky idea in 1895, he really was the first person to do that. He was the first person even to dream of it. And so the first thing I wanted to know was why. Why hadn't people thought about these things before? And then the second thing was, why all of a sudden was it possible to have these fantasies?
And the thing that's striking about H.G. Wells' time machine is it only goes into the future. It does not go into the past.
Right. He's able to return home, but he doesn't even bother going to visit Shakespeare, find out what Shakespeare was like, which is sort of odd considering that Wells was a historian and was certainly interested in the past. But Wells was also, by temperament, and he said this himself, a futurist. That was a word that was not very common in those days. And he was very excited about the future and felt that it was important to be forward-looking and progressive thinking, and that all the smart people should be wondering what the world is going to be like and taking an active role in creating the future.
Just a few years after that, Einstein comes along and gives us a scientific understanding of time, a very new take on time. Was it just an accident that you sort of had this new physics of time just as kind of the science fiction about time travel is coming into being?
Yeah, funny coincidence, huh? That's sort of the $64,000 question. H.G. Wells' Time Traveler starts off the story with a little lecture to his friends about how time is nothing but a fourth dimension, like a fourth spatial dimension, which they had not imagined before. This is a wacky new idea that he has to explain it in great detail. And then 10 years later, Einstein comes along and announces that, in fact, this is how the universe is. What are we supposed to think? Was Wells prescient? Was he up to date with the new physics? Actually not. He was interested in science, but he didn't know anything about physics. And Einstein, in turn, as far as – I mean, I would have loved it if I could have discovered Einstein reading the time machine and saying, aha, but that is not what happened.
Mm-hmm. So Einstein, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I mean, one of Einstein's big ideas is that time was not absolute. I mean, that was the old idea of Isaac Newton, that, you know, time was just sort of one thing forever. And Einstein said, no, it's actually relative.
Einstein discovered that there's no such thing as a single clock for the entire universe, that each of us has his or her own clock, and it will change its speed depending on how fast we're moving. So if you speed up, especially close to the speed of light, your personal clock runs slower compared to the clocks of people who are standing still. And this, of course, quickly became a great time travel device because people could get into their spaceship and zoom around for a while and then return to Earth and discover, just like Rip Van Winkle, that everybody else had gotten very old or else died. If you saw Interstellar a couple of years ago,
yeah,
they use exactly the same gimmick because it's actually true according to the laws of relativity. It's a kind of unsatisfying version of time travel because there's no going back. It's just that your clocks slow down.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like, I mean, what Einstein did is he kind of broke down this sense that there is kind of this absolute divide between past, present, and future, right? It all kind of, I don't know, flows together.
Yes, a consequence of thinking about time as a fourth dimension is that you can imagine, and physicists do this mathematically speaking, the whole universe as a big block, the space-time continuum, a four-dimensional block where time is just one more direction and the past and the future are built in, so to speak. The past has happened, but it's right there for us to look at mathematically. And the future, while it seems to us that it hasn't happened, is also right there. And so the time traveler could just pick up and go from one place to another. I don't think that's necessarily how reality is. I think that's a nice mathematical model, but it's sort of key to a notion of how time travel might actually work.
So getting back to time travel in fiction, I have to ask you about a story by the great science fiction writer Robert Heinlein. He wrote the story called By His Bootstraps, published in the pulp magazine Astounding Science Fiction in 1941. Can you tell me about that story?
Yeah, I love that one. Part of what I love about all of these stories is looking at them and noticing how naive they are, how everything has to be explained very carefully to the reader because it isn't assumed that we know all of this stuff. So in Robert Heinlein's story, there's a narrator who's sitting in his room and he's writing some kind of thesis that has vaguely to do with time. You get some pompous sounding philosophical title of the thesis. And then lo and behold, a bubble bursts in the air next to our hapless hero and a man walks through who looks a little like our hero, but he's got a 3-day growth of beard and he's got a bruise on his face. And he says, oh, don't bother with that crap. It's all a lot of nonsense. We realize right away because we've read these stories, we've seen the movies, that this is the same guy. But the guy doesn't recognize himself and hilarity ensues. It gets more and more complicated. Then the phone rings and it's another version of the same guy. And eventually, the guy who is now in the far distant future has to create the conditions in which it's possible for him to travel through time and yet not get into trouble.
On one level, this is just kind of a very clever story. You know, it sort of catches your imagination. But there are some deeper questions here which have to do with who we are, with the self, and with, you know, with our minds. Are we the same person that we were 20 years ago or 40 years ago? Will we be the same person, you know, decades ahead, or does something change about us?
Yeah, I think that's the secret of all the different kinds of time travel fantasy. And really, that's why I ended up being so fascinated with the subject that's really the motivation for the book, is that time travel stories aren't just fun. They're telling us something about ourselves and about the world we live in that we can't really explore in other ways. Philosophers talk a lot about time. Physicists talk a lot about time. And they're all living in the same culture as the rest of us, reading the same science fiction and imagining these twists and turns and variations. You've expressed one reason this story is so telling is that it's comic when Bob, in Heinlein's story, meets himself and gets into a fist fight. And then they start to think about, well, if I'm meeting myself, how come I don't remember that that happened before? Or how come only one of me remembers? And when we think about that, we can't help but be thinking about our own experiences when we think about the past. You know, we have our memories, and then we think back on something that we remember from 5 years ago. And then we remember that the last time we told this story, we thought about it sort of differently. And are we the same person now as we were when we were remembering the story last time and telling the story? And when we tell the story again tomorrow, are we the same person or a whole different person? These are not easy questions, and there are no absolute answers to any of them coming to us from philosophers or physicists, so we may as well explore them in our storytelling.
So what do you think? Are we the same person that we were yesterday or 5 years ago?
Well, what do you think? I think there's a little of both. I think we have a sensation of continuity in our personalities. Of course we're the same person. We have the same name. We have the same memories. We use the same personal pronoun. I did that when I was 6 years old. That wasn't somebody else. And yet, we're also able to tell ourselves exactly the opposite. I'm a different person now. I didn't do that. I would never do that. I am not the kind of person who does that. And we're also experts on regret, and we wish we could have second chances. And that's another powerful motivation for time travel stories, the desire to do things over. We can imagine ourselves going back in time and taking a different path.
So why do you think we are so obsessed with time travel? Is there a deeper reason here?
Yes, because we're obsessed with time, because time is what we care about. Time rules our lives. Time creates possibilities for us and also terminates possibilities for us. Time is a harsh mistress. We struggle with it every day of our lives, and more now than ever in the past. So it's natural for us to turn to these stories to look for some insight or just to get some relief from a difficult reality.
Well, and you say something else in your book. It's to elude death.
I think that's maybe the secret hidden motivation for most time travel, or for that matter, for most of our worries about time. It's our mortality that we're concerned with, and time travel gives us a way to invent, at least temporarily, a kind of immortality.
Well, and then it's fascinating. I mean, just thinking about everything that goes along with death. I mean, not just thinking about our own death, but the death of loved ones. I mean, you know, what is mourning? But in some sense, going back to the time when the person was alive.
Yeah. When I say that time travel wasn't invented to the end of the 19th century, we can still remember that ancient Greeks in their legends imagined the underworld where when you crossed the river Styx to Hades, you were able to meet your ancestors once again. Now that we know all about time travel, we could think of that as a version of time travel. Any story that allows you to meet your ancestors is in the time travel category, and a lot of modern time travel is motivated by exactly that.
James Glick is the author of Time Travel, A History. He talked with Steve Paulson. So that point, that the dream of time travel maybe springs partly from grief and longing for people we've lost, that describes theoretical physicist Ron Mallet. He spent a lot of his career studying time, and he traces his interest back to the tragedy that marked his childhood.
It was actually when I was 10 years old. My father, he was a wonderful person, and for me, the sun rose and set on him. But no one knew just how ill he was. He looked like a very robust person, and he died suddenly of a heart attack. He was only 33 years old. Mm. And it completely destroyed my world. And I went from being a rather happy kid to a rather depressed kid. But one of the gifts that he left me was a love for reading. And shortly after he died, I came across H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. It was like, oh, wow, this is it. This is the answer. Because I thought if I could build a time machine, then I could see him again. I could go back into the past and see him again.
And actually save his life?
That's right. So that became my holy grail. My goal was to try to build a time machine to see him again and tell him what was going to happen and maybe keep him from dying. So that was actually the beginning of my interest in time travel. The thing that you might say solidified for me, though, was a couple of years later, I came across a popular level book about Einstein. And in that book, it said that time was not something that was absolute. Time could be changed. So that meant to me that what H.G. Wells had said could be true. And so I really knew that this is what I had to do, was to try to understand Einstein so that I could build this time machine.
So you wound up doing your graduate work and you got your degree and you began moving up the academic ladder as a physicist. What happened to your interest in time travel during those years?
The thing is that even when I was a kid, I knew that people were concerned about me because I was in this depressed state. And so I was astute enough to realize not to tell them that I was wanting to build a time machine, because I didn't want to think about dealing
really
with the consequences
of that.
Exactly. And of course, when I was going up the academic ladder, you know, I thought, if I tell my colleagues I'm interested in building a time machine, right, when you get tenure, forget it, you know.
So, but was it something you were still thinking about, or had progressed so far in physics you'd put the idea of time travel away?
No. See, the thing is that what I did was I developed a cover plan. You have to realize that in physics is a strange beast. There's what people call legitimate crazy ideas, and then there's what people call crazy ideas. Now, black holes were legitimate crazy. In other words, in black holes, it turns out that black holes are connected with Einstein's work, and black holes are connected with time.
Ron Mallett is a theoretical physicist and author of Time Traveler, a scientist's personal mission to make time travel a reality. Coming up, we'll revisit one of the greatest time travel comedy movies of all time, Groundhog Day. And we'll even rethink time itself. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Do you ever have the feeling that you're stuck in a time loop on autopilot, just doing the same thing day after day after day? Hopefully, you've never experienced it literally, the way Bill Murray did in Groundhog Day. Harold Ramis directed the film, which came out in 1993. Danny Rubin wrote the screenplay, and Doug Gordon sat down to talk with him. And if this interview sounds familiar, that's because this is a rebroadcast, which seems appropriate.
Danny, for those few people out there who haven't seen Groundhog Day, the one or two, and even for those who have seen it, it's probably only fitting to be reminded. Can you give us a summary of the storyline?
A cynical, self-centered, Pittsburgh-centered weatherman is sent to cover the annual Groundhog Festival in Punxsutawney, which is something he does not look forward to, and winds up repeating that same day, waking up every morning in Punxsutawney against his desires.
Yeah.
And defying any explanation.
So how did you come up with the idea?
I was just trying to come up with an idea for a movie. Everywhere I looked, I was thinking about, oh, would that be a movie? Oh, there's a guy with a shovel. Is that a story? and I was in a movie theater waiting for the lights to come down. I had a book about vampires, and I was just sort of thinking about things, and I was musing about what's cool about vampires is they're like people, only some of the rules are different, and one of the cool rules is that they can live forever. So I started thinking, oh, I wonder what it would be like to live forever, and would a person change differently than if they only had one lifetime? And what about one of these arrested development kind of guys who can't quite grow up? Maybe one lifetime isn't enough. So I was really trying to tell a story about eternity and how that affected a person. It was just a very cumbersome idea, even though I thought it was kind of interesting. And then I remembered one of a gazillion ideas I'd scratched out over the last couple of years, and it was a guy repeats the same day over and over again, which seems like that's the whole movie right there, but it really isn't. It had to be about a human life and had to be about something. And what I found out was that I could capture the feeling of eternity by turning it on its tail and making a circle. So a person repeating the same day over and over again could be a story of a person living a very, very long lifetime.
This is one time where television really fails to capture the true excitement of a large squirrel predicting the weather. I, for one, am very grateful to have been here. From Punxsutawney, this is Phil Connors. So long.
Okay, we'll try it again without the sarcasm.
We got it.
What did you think of the choice of Bill Murray to play Phil Connors?
I had kind of mixed feelings. I didn't automatically say, oh, my God, Bill Murray's going to be in my movie. This is great, even though I love his performances and always enjoy his movies. I was afraid it was turning into a Harold Ramis comedy.
He had worked with Bill quite a bit with both Caddyshack and, of course, Ghostbusters.
Exactly right. So I was not thinking like a smart Hollywood success goal-oriented person. I was thinking of trying to protect my script. And Bill did not seem like the best choice for that. But Harold argued to me that he, not that he needed my consent or anything, but he was trying to make me feel good about the whole thing. And he said, Bill can do this. Don't worry about it. He really can. Mm-hmm. And he really did.
What do you think it was that Bill brought to the character of Phil Connors?
Well, he brought Bill Murray. In spite of how extraordinary he is, there's an everyman quality to him. Mm-hmm. And there's something recognizable in his performance that makes people say, oh, I know people like that, or I'm like that.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
I'd say the chance of departure is 80%.
Do you have a favorite scene or a favorite moment in Groundhog Day?
The very first thing I thought of that made me say, oh my God, this is a movie, was the picking up Rita scene, being able to use knowledge from previous dates to manipulate the situation and give her the perfect day. Mm-hmm. That to me was, it was funny and it was clever and it was fun and it was character building and it was absolutely unique to this premise. And it worked perfectly. I loved it.
Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Sweet vermouth rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine too. It always makes me think of Rome. The way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
Well, what should we drink to?
I like to say a prayer and drink to world peace.
To world peace.
World peace.
Groundhog Day has really resonated with people. In a list of the best comedy films of all time that the American Film Institute put together, Groundhog Day came in at number 34. People like Monty Python's Terry Jones hold it in very high esteem. Does the film's staying power and all this critical acclaim surprise you?
No. I don't mean that to sound arrogant.
No, it doesn't sound arrogant.
Oh, I should try harder. No.
Well, yeah, now it's a little arrogant. Yeah.
Brilliant. It always felt special to me, and there was a cleverness to it, and there was an originality to it that felt like it would lift it above the other comedies. And then in terms of just the humor and how much you laugh, I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
But the fact that it has all this power behind it of a kind of non-manipulative truth, it just feels real and that, to me, makes everything else more powerful. It seems like that would be the kind of impression people would get, that it's a really great comedy.
Yeah, a thinking person's comedy, for sure. What kinds of letters and notes did you get after the film was first released?
The first kind of notes mostly came from not from America, from England and from Germany. And I was getting notes from monks and from people of different religious persuasions and, and psychologists who were prescribing the movie to their patients. And so they were remarkable letters. And Harold and I kept in touch with each other, and he was getting them as well.
Hmm. And you heard from a lot of Buddhists as well, right?
Buddhists, yeah. There was a film festival in New York or something on religious-themed films, and everybody wanted Groundhog Day. And I think in the end, the Buddhists won.
Rita, I'm reliving the same day over and over. Groundhog Day, today.
So why do you think Groundhog Day has struck such a chord with so many people? What is it about the film?
I think it deals with the fact that our lives are made up of a series of days, and every day can feel like the next. And very often we do have this, you know, this human phenomenon of feeling like we're stuck and that we can't get out, that we're sort of trapped in our own lives. And I don't think that there is a movie existing, and certainly not a comedy movie, that has absolutely embraced that human experience before.
For sure. I've read somewhere that you said Phil's best day ever is the same day as his worst day, and there's this extremely empowering message that the world changed because Phil changed. It's a real strong story about character growth.
And it empowers each of us, because if Phil's story is true, and it certainly feels true after we've gone through the hour and a half, we feel like we have that power too. If the day needs changing, we can wait for something else to change it, or we can do something. There's something we can change in ourselves to see the day differently and experience it differently.
Oh, for sure. And you're not done with Groundhog Day. You turned it into a musical. Recently had its premiere at the Old Vic in London, and it will be coming to Broadway in April. I'm guessing that adapting it for the stage didn't seem like such a Phil Connors experience, because you were reimagining it for a different medium. What was that like?
It was very exciting. It was a lot of fun. It gave me a chance to revisit all of the decisions that Harold and I made in making the movie, and some that Harold made without me and some that I had made originally, and revisit them all and sort of start from scratch and feel like if I were going to write the whole thing now as a musical for the first time, what would that be like?
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you this, and I'll defer to your judgment about revealing spoilers, because we don't want to do that, because it's already played at the Old Vic in London, but it's coming to Broadway, I think, in the spring. What is different about the musical? How does it differ from the film, or is that going to ruin it?
Well, I can say, without fear of ruining it, that there is singing.
Wow, okay, spoiler. We'll have to tack on a spoiler alert. I can't use that, Denny.
A lot of the reviews and things that I read were talking about the challenge of making us forget that it's Bill Murray and creating a new character for Phil that will certainly be relatable from, you know, people who've seen the movie, but doesn't make us wish that we were watching Bill Murray again. And part of that is the power of a musical. Bill Murray, the character of Phil Connors, breaking into song doesn't feel like what he would do. If he did anything, he would probably be the only person who refused to sing.
Yeah.
And frankly, that was one of the things I thought about.
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Like, when he finally sings, is starting to show his transformation.
Yeah. And you obviously have seen the production at the Old Vic in London, right?
Oh, I saw all of them.
Wow. Well, how appropriate.
I know.
I have to ask you this. If you had to get stuck in a time loop and repeat the same day over and over again, I'm curious about which day would pick, if you had the control, the power to pick today, because I'm pretty sure it's not going to be today. Because can you imagine having to talk to me over and over and over again?
So far, it's okay. Today would be fine. It's a beautiful day in Santa Fe. And anyway, I don't have a day like that. I really don't. And it's partly because that's not the way I'm oriented. I don't really look back much. And I do look forward, and I do try and build new days that are at least as good as the best one I used to have.
There is something so familiar about this.
Hmm?
Do you ever have deja vu?
Didn't you just ask me that?
Danny Rubin wrote the classic comedy Groundhog Day, and he also wrote the book for the musical version, which was recently nominated for a Tony Award. He talked with Doug Gordon. We all think about time, but probably not as deeply as the groundbreaking theoretical physicist Lee Smolin. He's created a radical new view of the nature of time and the cosmos, which he lays out in a new book called Time Reborn, From the Crisis in Physics to the Future of the Universe. Steve Paulson wanted to know more.
Now, my understanding, since Einstein, we've had this concept of space-time. They go together, the idea that time and space are inextricably linked to each other. Is that a mistake?
I don't think it's a mistake at all. The notion of space-time captures a deep truth about the world, which is that the notion of, well, let me just say it, this will be familiar to some of our listeners and maybe a shock to others of our listeners, but the idea that we can say what events are happening simultaneous to now, simultaneous to this moment at some location far away is not so obvious. And Einstein pointed out that if you give me a procedure to tell which events far away are simultaneous with the present events, that procedure will depend on my motion. And that's a deep truth, and that has a great deal of experimental evidence by now in favor of it. But that doesn't prevent it from being true or possible that there's a deeper notion of time which underlies the universe in which there is a fundamental and global notion of time which comes prior to the notion of time in Einstein's space-time. See, there can be different levels of description at which different regularities are true, in which we can assume different laws approximately hold. And the importance of special and general relativity doesn't mean that it might not be someday superseded for a deeper understanding of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is the common assumption that there was no time before the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago. I mean, there was nothing before then. Do we need to rethink that everything started with the Big Bang?
I think we do. And this is not a new idea. The idea that the Big Bang is the first moment of time is a consequence of Einstein's theory of general relativity in isolation from the other laws. But it's been understood for a great deal of time, since at least the early 1960s, that when one tries to combine general relativity with quantum phenomenon, one has not a first moment of time, but a transition from an earlier era. So the idea that there is time before the Big Bang has been with us, really, with us theoretically, since the early 1960s. Now, that doesn't mean that the idea is demonstrated scientifically. It means that we theorists are comfortable with the idea that there was an era of the universe before the Big Bang, and that the Big Bang was a magnificent event, a transition from a previous era, but not the beginning.
So where would the Big Bang have come from? I mean, because my understanding of the sort of the models of the Big Bang is it sort of kind of exploded out of nothing, it would seem.
Yes, and out of nothing can't be a scientific idea, because what do you mean? How can something come out of nothing? So there are two hypotheses as to what preceded the Big Bang, both of which have been studied quite a bit. One hypothesis is that there was a black hole in another universe, and that the star that collapsed to form that black hole would, again, according to Einstein's classical theory of relativity, have compressed and compressed and compressed and very quickly reached a state of infinite density where time stops, so a kind of end state. And the idea, again, has been around for a long time that's not really an end state, but it prepares the way for a transition where quantum effects create a new universe, which then becomes the new Big Bang. So that's the idea that the history of our universe is, the prior history is the collapse of a star to a black hole in another universe. So that's one idea which has been developed. Another idea is that the universe as a whole might come to an end state. The universe as a whole might collapse, and the Big Bang comes as a kind of bounce, we say, if you can see the metaphor of, you know, bouncing a ball. The universe might collapse and then bounce and then expand again. And that's an idea which also has been well explored. So we have two hypotheses in front of us. And the interesting thing is whether they make different predictions for what the early universe looks like, which can be differentiated by experiment or observation.
Hmm. Well, it also sounds like you're suggesting that there is no original start date for everything. I mean, you keep going back forever.
Steve, that's too hard. It's one thing to push time back before the Big Bang, but I'm a scientist. I'm not a philosopher. I don't have to answer an ultimate question like, was there an ultimate first moment of time? That's like one of these questions like consciousness or why does the world exist at all rather than nothing, which at least the present time is too hard for us scientists.
You write about how it is important to think in time. What does that mean?
Well, I try to convey in the book the change in my own sense of myself and my situation in life as I went through this transition of believing that time is really real and time is really fundamental. Because you see, Steve, this was a transition I went through myself over many years, starting with the conventional point of view among my colleagues that time is an illusion. I slowly worked my way to the opposite point of view. And this affected my own life. It affected my experience of being a parent. It affected my experience of being a person in society. It affected my experience of being an adult, growing older. And I wanted to convey this because this had such a profound effect on me. So I invented a kind of contrast between thinking outside of time and thinking in time and living outside of time and living in time. And we live and think outside of time when we have the fantasy that the real truths that matter exist timelessly outside of time, that we can at best rediscover or re-inherit truths which are eternal. When we think that the solutions to all the problems that we face as people or the possible political frameworks or political points of view all exist in some sense timelessly, then we look outside of time for the solutions of our problems, personal and societal. On the other hand, we live in time when we reject that as some mystical fantasy and believe that the future is open and subject to our creation at least a little bit.
Well, one of the ideas that that you often hear from physicists and well-known physicists is that according to the laws of physics, time should be able to move backwards as well as forwards. I mean, this is the reason that many physicists say that time travel into the past is theoretically possible. Sounds like that does not fit into your framework.
Well, not really. And if time travel into the past was possible, then where are they? Where are our future friends and colleagues who have traveled into the past to save us from our foolishnesses or just to entertain themselves? Where are they? That's a much worse question than the question about the aliens. How come they're not here? But yes, one of the funny things about fundamental physics is how some of the conclusions that we're led to clash with everyday expectations, and we have to work hard to disabuse ourselves of those everyday expectations. Now, sometimes that's right. For example, the air appears to be smooth. The metal of this piece of table I'm sitting in front of appears to be smooth, but that's really an illusion that's really made of atoms. So sometimes it's right that everyday experience is an illusion, but sometimes it's wrong, and this is a case where I think it's correct. So just to come back to the issue you raised, almost everything that we experience in ordinary life about time is not reversible. When we spill milk, when we get up in the morning, when we have a child, a first kiss, an unkind word said to a friend, almost everything we experience is irreversible. But the laws of nature, as we have understood them from Newton to Einstein to quantum theory, appear to be reversible. That is, if you've made a movie of what the atoms are actually doing in all the circumstances of life on a fundamental scale, on an atomic scale, and ran that movie backwards, that would not contradict the laws of nature. And that raises a profound question. Why is everyday experience, everyday phenomenon, why is that so irreversible? So much has a one direction to it. if the fundamental laws are reversible, and cosmologists and physicists have to go into all kinds of convolutions about how improbable the beginning state of the universe was to try to explain that. I think it's much easier just to say that fundamentally time must be irreversible and the apparent reversibility of the laws on the atomic scale.
Lee Smolin is a theoretical physicist and author of Time Reborn, From the Crisis in Physics to the Future of the Universe. He talked with Steve Paulson. And coming up, the story of a real-life time capsule, a mysterious apartment in Paris recently opened for the first time in 70 years. I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We've been talking about time travel today, and I have to confess, I've never been a huge fan of the whole paradoxes of time theme that's so popular in science fiction. But I do love historical fiction, which I guess is a kind of time travel, especially when it's based on true events and real people, like Alison Richman's latest novel, The Velvet Hours, which was inspired by a recent newspaper story in the Paris Press.
A good friend of mine read this article online about a mysterious Parisian apartment that once belonged to an elusive courtesan by the name of Martha de Florian. And the granddaughter of Martha de Florian closed this apartment just before the Germans came into Paris during World War II and never returned to it, yet paid the maintenance on it until her death in 2010. You know, as soon as I read this story that my friend sent me with the lines, "You need to write this as a novel," my mind began spinning with all sorts of questions. You know, who was Martha de Florian? What was her relationship with her granddaughter? And why did Solange close the apartment, keeping it as a shrine to her grandmother?
So Alison couldn't stop thinking about this mysterious apartment, and she wound up trying to find out more.
The facts were pretty sparse. We do know that Martha de Florian wasn't born with that name. She was born with the name Mathilde Beauguiron. So we know that she changed her name, that her mother was a laundress, and that she herself, before becoming a kept woman in this sensual apartment, was a seamstress. And her heirs discovered on the last will and testament that there was this apartment in the 9th arrondissement of Paris. And when it was opened, this beautiful, sumptuous apartment was covered in a veil of dust. And above the marble mantel was a portrait of their great-grandmother, painted by the very famous 19th-century painter Giovanni Boldini, who was a contemporary of John Singer Sargent. Love letters from the artist were found in Martha de Florian's vanity, tied with satin ribbon, and other paramours, but specifically him. And so that plays a part in the novel as well.
What did the apartment look like when it was first opened? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it because when I actually went to start researching the novel, the apartment had already been sold and the contents as well. I did work with a historian who tried to contact the auctioneer who handled the selling of the painting and the contents, specifically because I was interested to see if I could read the letters that Boldini had written Martha de Florian.
These but love letters.
The love letters, because I was really curious, was it a mutual, you know, infatuation?
Was she in love with the artist, or was he just
exactly.
in love with her?
Exactly. I mean, before I started writing, and I wanted to understand the facts. But my historian was told that the love letters were burned by the heirs of the estate. Now, I personally don't believe that's true. I actually think that was an answer to sort of just end anyone trying to investigate any more of the story, probably because they were being pestered by so many different people to find out. I mean, everyone was sort of interested in this.
I mean, how could you burn story? Your great, how could great you burn grandmother's them? Letters?
But, the woman but it's the only way to shut up a writer in New York who really wants to read those letters.
Right.
So, you know, I received that information with a bit of disappointment, but at the same time, as a novelist, it enables you to say, well, I tried to do my due diligence, and now I'm going to imagine what happened.
And Marta de Florian, she was a courtesan, a kept woman. Mm-hmm. Explain what that was at that period of time.
Well, she was almost like the way we imagine a geisha, someone with very cultivated taste and elegance and who really takes great pleasure in the different layers of seduction. I think that's really something that's different than when we think of a prostitute who's just trying to make money by selling her body. This is more an experience of beauty, pleasure, elegance, and researching the novel, I was really taken to how there were sorts of all rituals of just pre-seduction, you know, the different types of baths you take. You take one steeped in lime blossom. You take a cold one to make your skin firm. You know, you used powders that were made out of crushed pearl in order to increase iridescence on your skin. You used rose oil not just for dewiness and to increase the pink circulation so you looked sort of like a newly picked flower, but that the smell, the aromatherapy of it. So of all my novels, this was the most fun to research because it really showed, you know, a side of feminine beauty that I wasn't familiar about, especially being a busy mom. It's really, I can get ready in 10 minutes. Believe me, there's no lime blossom and there's certainly no rose oil.
But it's the portrait of a woman who made herself into a work of art.
Exactly. And that's a really, really wonderful way to put it. Yeah, she literally cast off the shadow of Montmartre of being literally a daughter of a laundress.
And to extend the metaphor further, her lover, the man who gave her this apartment, set her up in it, furnished it, gave her an income, he was her collector. He was an art collector. And
exactly.
she was an item in his collection.
Exactly. And he visited her on his own schedule. So she's hidden. I mean, there's that poem too, the de Florian poem that he brings her about to be happy to remain happily hidden.
You know, from a contemporary feminist sensibility, I mean, this seems reprehensible. She's just this object who's kept by this man
for his pleasure,
caged for his pleasure while he has another life and a wife and a family that she can never meet. You know, there's a whole politics of this that is fairly...
There is, and I think, but if you look at it from the fact of how financially savvy she is in this situation, she does carve out her own form of independence. I mean, it's you could never put our feelings of feminism on a character like Marta de Florian or any woman at that time, I think, because, you know, there was no women's rights at that period. Mm-hmm. A courtesan had more rights than a married woman, for sure. Certainly a middle-class, you know, or upper-middle-class woman.
You have a background in art, and there are art objects, you know, sort of scattered throughout the novel. It makes it somehow very tactile to read about. But I wonder about, for you, that, you know, if there are backstories or deeper symbolism behind some of these things. For instance, there's a magnificent set of pearls given to Marta by her lover when he knows that he's dying, and he gives her this. If she sells them, that'll be enough money to live on for the rest of her life. Any particular inspiration for those pearls?
Well, for the pearls, there is an inspiration. About 5 years ago, my grandmother, who actually just passed away a few months ago, gave me a set of pearls and told me that the pearls had belonged to the love of her life and that it wasn't my grandfather, and that she wanted me to know the story about the pearls before she passed away. And I was really surprised to hear this, because of course, you know, as a granddaughter, you expect that your grandmother's love of her life is the grandfather that you always knew.
I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, how did I feel, honestly, Anne? I was shocked. But my grandfather was a very hard man, and my grandmother was a very soft woman. So in some way, it made sense that she had thought about this person her whole married life, probably, and that she still kept these pearls. So I now wear them a lot, and I always think about the fact that every person's life has these secrets that so many people don't know about, and that in a lifetime, probably people have more than one love, and that love is typically kept private to them, but only they know the story unless they're willing to share it at the end of their life. But truly, I mean, jewelry is one of the few things we wear on our body that almost always contains a story. It's either given to us to commemorate something. It could be an heirloom that connects us with someone that we love from the past. We might buy it ourselves to commemorate a certain accomplishment. But typically, it has a story, and really that's what makes it so valuable.
It's funny. One of the things I love, the thing that I just keep coming back to, I know it's not a character, but it's that apartment, the idea of a secret apartment, secret rooms. I think that that somehow is almost an archetype, something we're very drawn to, but I'm not really sure why.
Well, I think I might know. I think for me, even writing it, this idea that there could be an architectural space that was able to shut out time and technology and all the things that have happened. I mean, it literally, like, you close the door and time stood still. And I think that's a very attractive thought for us in today's world when we're constantly chasing to keep up with everything and there's never enough time. But what if time stopped? And what if you shut a door and everything was quiet and beautiful? It's a very attractive thought.
Something about thresholds, I guess. I'm thinking about how many children's books begin with a child opening a door and crossing a threshold into some other reality.
I love, like, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm thinking of that right away. Like, I love that idea of you opened up those doors and you stepped in and you fell into another world, or Alice in the Wonderland. It is a magical thought.
And the past is another world. So, you know, maybe that's the appeal. You open this door and you're magically transported back into the past. And, you know, sadly, there aren't those doors in real life. But I guess I think that's what books are. You know, I think that's what a novel is. You turn that page.
And you step into that world.
Yes, and the cover of a book is even shaped like a doorway. You know, it's like you walk into this magical other world for a while.
I agree.
So thanks for taking us there.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alison Richmond has written 6 historical novels, and we were talking about her latest, called The Velvet Hours. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Doug Gordon produced this hour. He had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, Mark Rickers, and Kirill Owen. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.